Hello, I'm Jason Solomons. Welcome to Film Weekly. On this week's show...
Maybe this is a coincidence, but the last three films that I did is always about characters. I mean, small characters dealing with huge problems that they can't control, they can't deal with, but they have to.
Yes, the talk of Cannes this year was Fernando Meirelles' Blindness. It finally hits the big screens here in the UK this week. I'll be talking to Fernando about his unique visual contribution to world cinema and why this cinematic visionary was attracted to José Saramago's challenging book. And Zan Brooks is back to lend his critical skills to the review section as we run down the week's releases, including Sam Rockwell and Kelly MacDonald in Choke, Leonardo DiCaprio and Russell Crowe in Body of Lies, and Waltz with Bashir, Ari Folman's unique exploration of memory and violence. But first...
Time after time, I tell myself that I'm so lucky.
Jazz singer Jackie Paris had it all, a wondrous, mellifluous voice, the respect and admiration of peers such as Charles Mingus, Charlie Parker, and Dizzy Gillespie, and most importantly, a great stage name. So why did Jackie Paris disappear? This question is at the heart of a superb new documentary by Raymond DeFelita, entitled Tis Autumn, The Search for Jackie Paris. I spoke to Ray on the phone from his home in New York to find out why he decided to go on this search for a lost musical talent. But first, let's hear an extract from Ray's film. Jackie Paris had some bad luck in his career, but it wasn't for want of famous names who loved him.
You've got a date with Peggy Lee.
Well, a guy is a guy, and a guy like Jackie Paris is a guy I'd like to sing with. So, Jackie, if Russ Case will look our way for a downbeat, let's go with Oh, Look at Me Now.
Peggy was a champion of Jackie.
Yes.
Peggy Lee got him an audition with Capitol Records, and that was one of the few labels he didn't record for. But, you know, that's still, you know, pretty decent of her.
So they set me up at Capitol Recording Studio for Dave Cavanaugh and Dick Jones, who was the president and vice president. She sets up, she's got liquor. She had about 10 or 15 people. She was working at the Basin Street East, which was the big club then. And I got up and I sang, I don't know, four or five tunes. Boy, I thought I sang good. I mean, nothing. They never gave me one song to record.
It was an elaborate audition, full orchestra and everything. And Dave Cavanaugh simply would not buy it.
I wonder why not.
Because he didn't sound like anybody else.
And that also happened with me with Decca, Milt Gabler, big guy. He told the Mills Brothers he didn't like my sound, so how are you going to fight that?
Raymond, congratulations on your film, Tis Autumn, The Search for Jackie Paris. Why did you undertake a search for Jackie Paris?
Well, Jackie Paris was this, you know, this enigmatic, baffling figure to me for years. I had heard him on Los Angeles radio in the early 1990s, and you know, before the internet, finding out any of this obscure stuff was almost impossible, you know. So I spent years going to those record auctions and talking to other geeks like myself who, you know, were fascinated by old music.
There's a romance, isn't there, to it as well? There's a kind of gumshoe-style romance. The one is kind of like a detective, kind of going through the shadows of the past with all this.
Precisely, and although the internet has made all of this a lot easier, it's also taken a little of that shadowy glamour away from it. So it's, you know... I loved that part of it as well as being frustrated by it because there was so little of his recorded to begin with. So much of it had fallen out of print and was completely obscure to people. And it was even hard finding out facts about his life so that, you know, years later, a few years ago, when I found out that he was in fact alive, I'd thought he was dead for many years. And he was performing in Manhattan, I thought, you know, this might be an imposter because, you know, people do strange things like that. People do suddenly turn up and say, oh, yes, I was, you know, Spanky in the R Gang comedies. And, of course, they're just lying. You know, you have no idea what their real goal is or mission is in doing it. But, in fact, Jackie was Jackie. He was alive. He was 79. He was singing at a club here. And I also found out that he was terminally ill at the time. So I became sort of, you know, attached to him at that point. I wanted to tape him and find out what his life story was and who he was and why he had sort of drifted into the, you know, into the middle.
You I know you're a jazz pianist yourself and you're clearly a jazz fan. What was it about Jackie's vocal in particular that haunted you and grabbed you? I mean, you know, I have millions of great jazz vocalists at home myself, from Joe Williams to Nat King Cole to Sarah Vaughan to Ella Fitzgerald to Sinatra himself. Why did you think when you heard that first Jackie Paris song, who's this guy? I need to find out more about him. There must be more where this came from.
Yeah, you know, it's so hard to describe Jackie's voice. I mean, listening to it, I hear an empathy and a warmth, and at the same time, there's a slight edge of danger to his his delivery, and it's just a combination that I'd never really hear in another singer. And then, you know, when I start looking into his background, I find out that he's equally at home doing these big warm ballads as he is doing really hard bop. Which is what the school he came from, bebop, you know, was really invented when he was coming on the scene. So it's such a weird combination of things, but ultimately it's his personality is just, to me, so kind of warm and interesting. You know, yesterday was the 99th birthday, or would have been, of the great lyricist Johnny Mercer, and Johnny Mercer wrote Skylark, which was Jackie's signature song,
yeah.
You know. And I'm listening to local New York jazz radio, and they play Jackie's recording of Skylark. And I kid you not, the DJ comes on afterwards, and I can hear he's crying.
Oh, Skylark.
And it was so astonishing. And he said, Jackie Paris, Skylark, there's nothing you can say after listening to that record.
I think you're right. There's something about the personality that comes through in the voice, because, of course, until we see your film, I never knew what he looked like at all. You wouldn't know what this guy would look like. But the fact that he has the kind of, I suppose it's the thumbs up from peers like Mingus, like Charlie Parker, like Max Roach, who played on, like Roy Haynes, the great drummers that played in his rhythm sections, like Paquito de Rivera, who I noticed played on sax on some of his things. I mean, this guy moved in the most rarefied of jazz circles.
Yeah, he toured with Charlie Parker. Shamefully, they were never recorded together, but, you know, for Charlie Parker to give him that benediction. I mean, yeah, Jackie was jazz royalty. Unfortunately, in America, that's like saying you're subway royalty. I mean, you're just underground. You know, jazz has never been less appreciated than in the country that invented it.
But there's a plaintiveness and there's a kind of near deathness that hangs over your film, because we know that Jack is not long for this world, or his brief recognition that we're seeing in front of you on the screen is probably the kind of most famous he'll be, is that 2 hours that we're watching your movie.
Yeah, and it's true, because, you know, I think he realized too, when I was filming him, this was going to be sort of the ultimate document that was left. You know, now a number of CDs are easier to find and are finding their way back in print, but when Jackie was still alive, he basically saw that, you know, his music was vanishing. He wasn't being played much on the jazz stations either, which frustrated him a great deal. I remember I once said to him early on, when I first met him and didn't know him that well, I thought I was saying something, a compliment to him. I said, you know, your records fetch a lot of money on eBay. One of them was going for $300. And he said, yeah, what good does that do me? And I realized the peculiar kind of situation he was in. On the one hand, it must have been very hurtful to him. On the one hand, he knew that he was prized in a very rarefied way. On the other hand, he was broke. You know, and he didn't live to see his music really turn around and, like, gain him either the recognition or, you know, the financial recognition that he deserved.
In a way, it's what you mentioned before about the kind of absolute kind of, that's what happens to jazz, it's underground. You know, it's kind of, practitioners are so often penurious until they kind of die, and then we kind of appreciate them later. But what I liked about your film, Ray, if I may say, is that it was a search for Jackie Paris, yes, it was a search for kind of a lost kind of world of jazz and that kind of 52nd Street kind of hard-ass nightclubs and all that sort of stuff. But it was also the search for, by which we define our lives, a search for success, a search for health, a search for kind of, you know, are we living out our dreams in some way? And that's what I kind of came away with more than anything, that it was a search for, you know, maybe Jackie was happy that he didn't. He managed to kind of live out his dreams on stage quite often. He managed to kind of, you know, he may not have been successful, but he seemed quite happy that he'd managed to have a jazz life.
Yeah, I think he was ambivalent. He was very proud of what he accomplished, and he was very quick to tell you he was very proud. He knew who he was. On the other hand, and I think this is what sort of became the subject of the film, success as defined in America is financial. And so I think he struggled with the notion that even though he had success of a certain sort, he was not viewed as a success by the terms that our culture sets forth. You know, there's not a lot of room in American culture for art that doesn't make money.
Thank you, and congratulations on what is a very moving and very beautiful film, Tis Autumn, with a beautiful song called Tis Autumn, featuring in it. Tis Autumn, The Search for Jackie Paris. Thanks for joining us from New York today.
Thanks so much for the call.
And Tis Autumn, The Search for Jackie Paris, is on general release from Friday, the 21st of November. And if you want to hear more about this man and his voice, go to the great website, www.jackieparis.com. There's clips on there, there's information on there, and there's also a free track to download for your very ears. You're listening to Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons, and it's time to welcome back into the pod for our famous review section, Zan Brooks, roving Guardian film critic who roved so far last week that he wasn't even here. Welcome back, Zan.
I'm very, very glad to be back and that Peter hasn't taken over.
Well, you never know, mate. You never know.
Yeah.
We'll see how you do this week. We like to pit you against each other. Keeps you sharp.
Yep.
This week, Zan, we're going to look at Body of Lies. We're going to look at Choke. And then we'll look at two Cannes ghosts coming back to haunt us. That's Waltz with Bashir and Blindness. A busy week indeed. But let's start with Body of Lies, a film which stars Leonardo DiCaprio, Russell Crowe and Mark Strong, who we had on the show last week. This is about a Jordanian CIA operative, Leonardo DiCaprio, on the ground out there, while Russell Crowe dictates matters from back in Langley. He does, however, have a little trip to Jordan where he is in fine bullying form.
I'm just going to get all frustrated here.
Why are you frustrated?
Because we have a partnership. You have something that I need that will help me, and you're not going to allow that to happen. And I'm trying to impress upon you a sense of urgency.
I could tell you we will run him jointly, but it would not be the truth. Real intelligence operations, they remain secret forever. I know my business. I have never failed you, have I?
No, you have not. You sure you want to make this the first time?
So Ridley Scott directing, Russell and Leo back together again at last for the first time since God knows how long, 1995. Is this a mighty duo?
No, it's not. I hate to begin on a low note. It's not. Russell Crowe is fine. It's quite a sort of showy performance, and he sort of gives it his all as the sort of the paunchy neocon kind of barking orders. Yeah, he gained something like £50 for the role. Apparently, it's a real sort of De Niro tactic there from Raging Bull. DiCaprio, I'm still not convinced by in these kind of roles. I mean, what is he now? He's sort of early 30s,
yeah.
And yet he still looks like kind of wispy teenager.
And is this because he's trying to grow a beard in this role?
He's
and
got the
can't manage
sort of,
it?
Yeah, the wispy bum fluff beard that you'd normally see on kind of 19-year-olds. And I guess this is to signify his kind of new maturity. And, you know, here he's basically playing the kind of the acceptable face of CIA black ops. You know, he's sort of stricken with conscience and trying to speak Arabic and basically show sympathy for foreign cultures. And yet he never quite convinces. Also, he's saddled with a really spurious kind of love interest here, where he kind of romances a Muslim nurse from the local hospital, which inevitably gets him in all kinds of trouble. And you kind of think, surely if he's this much of a kind of smart, savvy CIA agent, he's going to know that this probably isn't the best way to go.
I thought this was a bit like one of those police dramas where they go deep undercover and they go so deep that they can't come back. And that's what Leo was doing here. He was kind of, you know, amassing information and Muslim culture so much so that he, you know, fell in love with it. But it, of course, that wasn't quite what was going on.
No, I think that, you know, the script is by William Monahan, who wrote The Departed, and there's some really interesting stuff in the script. It's trying for a kind of more nuanced, even-handed kind of approach to the war on terror and all the pitfalls of that and how best you go about waging that war. And yet it kind of keeps backing away from that, and it keeps kind of falling back into old Hollywood tropes. And really, this is like a sort of big fossil-fueled 20th century blockbuster that's trying to kind of adapt to this 21st century world. And it just never quite does it. It gets kind of bogged down.
I was reminded of a strange, uneasy mix, if you like, of Syriana. Mm. Which was George Clooney's rather kind of liberal examination of the oil mess, really, and the politics that obtained there, and also of a more Ridley Scott action, or even something like his brother's film, Tony Scott, when he did Enemy of the State. Lots of zooming on Google Earth, lots of kind of cameras, lots of kind of high-tech stuff, and plus a bit of kind of good old-fashioned blowing up Arab stuff.
Well, the weird thing about Ridley Scott is that he's almost like Hollywood's answer to Donald Rumsfeld. He's like this kind of old school sergeant major type who kind of goes blasting into the situation, has this kind of arm to the teeth, costly operation, and just basically bulldozes across the landscape. And here he's handling something that's a bit different. So he's great on all the kind of physical stuff and all the spectacle. It's as a sort of piece of spectacular filmmaking, it works. Mm. It's got a real kind of snap and pace and fantastic kind of action set pieces and very tense standoffs and things like that. But when he's actually trying to kind of tackle or navigate this terrain, he's just sort of spinning his wheels and he's obviously uncomfortable with it.
That's Body of Lies. Let's move on now to Choke, a rather different film with a smaller budget and back at home in America. A low-budget independent film written for the screen and directed by first-timer Clark Gregg. It tells the story of Sam Rockwell, who fancies himself as a bit of a lover, and Kelly MacDonald, who fancies herself as a bit of a nurse in a mental institution.
Where's Dr. Fielding?
Gone. Retired.
Are you in charge of my mother?
Name?
Victor.
Kurz.
Oh, Ida. Ancini.
You're the son.
Yeah.
The tour guide.
I'm not a tour guide. I'm a historical interpreter.
Okay. How come you never visit?
I visit all the time, just not as myself.
Kind of defeats the purpose, don't you think? She's an amazing woman, your mother.
Yeah. Listen, Dr.
Marshall. Dr. Paige Marshall.
Hi. She's getting worse. She never knows who I am anymore, and she won't eat.
Even when the lawyer comes to visit?
There's no lawyer. I'm the lawyer. Today she spat out cannelloni from Cicero's. That's like her death row favorite meal. I've seen her sprint 10 blocks in heels just to steal it.
Zan, this is Choke. This is a real US indie, it seems to me, of the old school. But it's also a romantic comedy. It's also about aging. It's also about defecation. It's also about death. It's also about lying and masturbation. It's everything. All life is here.
So all of my life is there in 90 minutes. And I guess because of that, I kind of like this. I thought it was a terrible mess. Like life. But it kind of has a certain sort of guilty pleasure. And Sam Rockwell is very good.
I love Sam Rockwell in most things.
He's really great. As this sort of, you know, Oedipal wreck of a man who is tending his demented mother, played by Angelica Houston, and is a sort of rapacious sex addict who has to sort of have treatment for that. And, you know, the thing about Hollywood films where, you know, the character is getting a lot of sex, they always sort of glamorize it and ennoble it. There's that awful Josh Hartnett film, was it 40 Days and 40 Nights, yeah, or something like that. This basically...
That's where he had to go without.
He had to go without sex, but then he had loads at the end as a sort of reward for his, you know, abstinence.
For being Josh.
This basically shows sex as pretty pitiful and pathetic and humiliating and generally calamitous.
And yet you know that most of the men in the audience are going, damn, I wish I could do that.
So I mean,
everywhere he goes, every plane he takes, every toilet he enters, he
but
just seems to be
it
shagging.
It does also make it seem like a proper pathology. And I thought that was good. I think the acting is very good. Houston is fantastic as the sort of formidable mum.
She still is. She's still got it, Angelica
she
Houston,
really has.
Hasn't she?
Yeah, she's fantastic.
We don't see much of her, but when she delivers, my God, she's got that stare that's icy. She's still sexy in a way.
Still sexy.
I've got no idea how old she is. For me, she's still...
She's kind of
the sort
ageless.
Of one, but, yeah,
she's
exactly.
Sort of monolithic.
Yeah.
But no, she's great in this. The problem, I think, is the writer-director, Clark Gregg, who, whether from budgetary constraints or whatever, kind of loses control of the material, doesn't quite know where it's going, whether this is a sort of really dark social satire, whether it's a sort of a bawdy sex romp, and it kind of like veers all over the
place. Yeah, it's written originally by the novel, which I haven't read, is by Chuck Palahniuk, who did, of course, Fight Club.
Yeah.
So it's got that kind of bitter edge to it, that bit of social satire, as you say, that comedy. I thought the tone of this was, in places, absolutely spot on. For example, Sam Rockwell works at a colonial kind of recreational playground. All that's very funny, where the kind of boss of the playground, like they would in a normal slacker comedy, work in, say, like a department store or a hardware store or a McDonald's.
Yeah.
And there'll be a sort of arsehole kind of boss. This one kind of talks in kind of 17th century colonial kind of, wouldst thou take off thou things. That's all very funny. But then when it veers wildly, the rest of the tone is sometimes depressing, sometimes kind of harsh.
There's another great scene where the Rockwell character meets a woman who wants him to rape her in this very kind of stage-managed way. And, of course, it all goes sort of horribly wrong. And that's very funny. But, yeah, it just goes all over the place. It's almost like... you know, to sort of push the masturbation metaphor to its climax.
Logical conclusion.
I guess.
Very good, there you go.
You know, it's almost like the writer director Clark Gregg gets sort of too excited by his material and kind of, you know, makes a mess of things.
A little bit early, perhaps. Mm. Yes. Well, it can happen. It's Film Weekly with Jason Solomons and Zan Brooks, running down the releases of the week. Zan, two films come back to us. We've talked about them before at Cannes. We'll deal with them just lightly this week. Let's go first with Waltz with Bashir, a film which we featured on Film Weekly from Israeli director and animator Ari Folman. This, I think, is one of the most distinctive and extraordinary films this year. In fact, we saw it together, in fact. I remember sitting next to you in the dark in Cannes, and we both looked at each other at the end and went, blimey.
I think this is one of my favourite films of the year. I think this is absolutely superb. It's people are talking about this as a documentary, which I'm not sure whether that portrays a kind of limited view of what a documentary is or shows the potential for a documentary.
Yeah, because maybe
This is, you know, a fictional animated reconstruction and an exploration of...
Are you getting technical there? You're saying this is not an animated... This is an animated fictional reconstruction and exploration. You know, clearly, that's the genre.
Far
here.
Snappier. But it's just brilliant. It sort of circles a massacre during the Lebanese War of 1982. It reminded me a little bit of Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five, in that it has that same kind of mercurial questioning manner. It's incredibly harrowing, but it's kind of playful as well.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think it's a documentary because the way it was actually shot was in a documentary. It's about Ari Folman trying to remember what happened when he was a soldier in that Lebanon war and going around his mates kind of that were left from that time, asking them, what, you know, where were you, where was I, what did we do? And they actually did it by, you know, recording those. He was actually talking as I am to you. And then afterwards, they kind of made the cartoon over that. So there was a documentary underneath.
Yes, that's the documentary. But then it also has all these kind of wild flights of fancy, these incredible kind of fictional, you know, asides and dream sequences where kind of mad dogs storm through town and, you know, a giant naked woman nestles a soldier to her breast in the sea. And it's just got all these kind of absolutely superb visual moments to it. And it's beautiful. I mean, it's thought-provoking, it's harsh, it's frightening. And a kind of like a woozy meditation on war. It's great.
I really enjoyed it as well in a very unenjoyable way. I found it, seeing it twice, I found it very oppressive. I found it very, very kind of intense as an experience as well. And I found myself strangely depressed after it, which is, I think, what a good war movie should do.
Absolutely. It doesn't glamorise it at all. I have a slight problem, I have to say, with the very last scene where he suddenly moves away from animation and shows actual kind of video footage of the massacre. From the 1980s. And Ari Folman said that he did this because he didn't want people to go out from the film saying, what a beautiful animation. He wanted to actually kind of rub their nose in the horror of it. But I'm not sure it works. I think it's almost like a repudiation. It's almost like he doesn't have confidence in the final moment.
It's like that little bit at the end of Schindler's List where they kind of go into a real video.
Yeah, it's a little bit crass.
Yes,
And also, he's created a world here. Just, you know, have faith in that.
And that's Waltz with Bashir. And Zan, the film that kicked off Cannes back in May was Fernando Morales' Blindness. We'll hear from Fernando a bit later in the show. But we liked Blindness when it kicked off Cannes. There were plenty of dissenting voices at the time. A film about Julianne Moore being the only woman who can see in a world that has gone blind, a world that's made up of Montevideo and San Paolo and a sort of small asylum outside Calgary in Canada. A world film, it seemed to me at the time. Do you still like it?
I love it. I was slightly surprised that this got such a rough ride. It's not perfect. It's a great kind of dystopian thriller. It's, you know, a world in meltdown, and it shows how kind of catastrophe can bring out the best in people as well as the worst. It's frightening at times. It's got a great kind of supporting role for Gael Garcia Bernal as this sort of gun-toting, food-hoarding demagogue in the next ward.
Yeah, he's good.
And, you know, it works, and I liked it a lot.
Yeah, seeing it again, it's a very upmarket, very art house, but very kind of mainstream as well in the kind of global cinema way. Zombie movie as well. You've got all these kind of blind people walking through. Kind of, you know, it's an essay on consumerism, an essay on as you say, blindness and seeing, and, you know, who sees in the village of the blind man, etc., etc. But not too crass, I didn't think, as well. And at times, very, very kind of... moving and kind of affecting as well. It kind of gets into your bones, not in the way that you'd think Fernando's film City of God. You think, oh, brilliant, favelas, excitement and guns and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, this is a quieter film. You know, if it can be said that, you know, it's a quieter film when it's all about the apocalypse and people clawing at each other. But it's a very measured, polished, professional job, and it works.
And aesthetically as well, I love the kind of milky blindness that happens while you expect things to be dark. In fact, they're extra light. Mm. They're too bright. And I did like the way that was handled as well. So I think we liked it. We had a poster for Blindness. It's a kind of must-see.
It's a must-see.
Thank you very much, Zan. Lovely to have you back. Hopefully you'll be back in the pod next week. But if you can't wait a moment more to read what Zan thinks about the world, the universe, life, everything, just go to guardian.co.uk/film. You're listening to Film Weekly with Jason Solomons. Now, as you perhaps know, I'm also hosting an in-depth series of interviews with top-notch directors entitled In the Director's Chair. It's on video. It's available on guardian.co.uk/in-the-director's-chair. So far, I've had great chats with Gurinder Chadha, Terence Davis, Walter Salles and Mark Forster, to name just a few. The latest instalment is the director of Blindness and City of God, Fernando Meireles. When I met up with Fernando, I started out by asking him how he landed this project. But first, let's hear a bit from the film, which stars Mark Ruffalo, Julianne Moore, Gael Garcia Bernal and Danny Glover, who plays the blind man. He relates the unfolding chaos caused by a strange and virulent pandemic of blindness.
What about the roads and traffic?
Chaos as usual. But then reports came of a bus crash with 23 casualties. That same day, two planes collided. No one could really say the disease was the cause of the accidents, but people were terrified, and either the panic spread the blindness, or the blindness spread the panic. Casualties multiplied. People decided to stay home. And the traffic problems were solved.
Yeah, well, actually, I read this story in 97, and I was very interested. I tried to buy the rights, but Saramago didn't want to sell it, so I just forgot it. And 6 years later, I got this invitation from this Canadian producer, Nee Fishman. He had the script ready with the same story, offering me the film. I mean, it was pure coincidence, because I didn't know him before. And so I signed the film, and the film shot. It took me 1 year. But it's true, to release the film is very complex. It's the most hard part of this job. I mean, I shot the film in 1 year and I'm releasing it almost for another year. Yeah. So
I mean, a year is quite a long time to shoot a film as well. Why did this
take so long? From the moment when they gave me the script till the film was finished was 1 year. Mm-hmm. So.
But it also
wasn't much, I think it's fair. I mean,
but you involved quite a few locations as well, because it's not just in one city, although it looks like one city.
Yeah, the film was shot 6 weeks in Canada, in Guelph. It's a small town inside a prison. And then a part in São Paulo, 6 weeks in São Paulo, where I live.
Well, that's
and
easy.
One, yeah, easy, at home. And 1 week in Montevideo, in Uruguay.
And they all come together. I mean, in the film, they're all in one city.
Yeah, it's supposed to be one city. But one city that we don't want the audience to recognize. It's a very generic city. Because it's not a story about a specific country or city or regime. It's really a story about mankind, so it should be very generic.
But, I mean, it does seem to me that when we watch a Fernando Meireles film, we're always taken on some kind of exotic journey. It might be frightening and it might be fraught with politics, or it might be fraught with danger or social elements, but they're always kind of against these kind of extraordinary locations.
Yeah, and I mean, I think maybe this is a coincidence, but the last three films that I did is always about characters. I mean, small characters dealing with huge problems that they can't control, they can't deal with, but they have to. So here again, it's the same situation. We have this kind of family of 7-8 characters dealing with this problem of the whole world became blind, and they have to manage to find their humanity back and go back home. And anyway,
do you think that this is why has this become a particular obsession with you? Because your films are about that structure, that social structure, and the little man or woman trying to kind of work out what's happening on a bigger scale.
I don't know. Maybe something that my shrink can explain why I'm obsessed with this kind of plot. But I'm sure that after this one, I want to go to a different direction. My next project probably is going to be a very simple, straightforward, hopeful and funny film, if possible.
I mean, I guess I was thinking, at the risk of being your shrink for a second, that there was something to do with your Brazilian-ness or your responsibility as a Brazilian artist, it seems to me, which comes through.
I think you're right. I mean, I'm 53. I always lived in Brazil. And in Brazil, we're always dealing with huge problems. I mean, we have social problems that everybody knows. I mean, there's a very rich part of the country and a very poor part of the country that doesn't really go together. And we're always dealing with this. And we lived in crisis and financial crisis for our whole life. Now, Brazil, for a change, in the last 5 years, we're in a great moment. The economy is growing. More jobs. I mean, finally, when all the world's going down, it seems that we're going up. So it's a good thing.
I suppose what defines your work is the work that you've done with your cinematographer, César Chalon, which I think is some of the most exciting visual work in film in the world. Can you just tell me a bit about how you worked together and how you created that hyper-saturated kind of palette that you've applied to both of them? And even more in Blindness, it's all about whiteness, I suppose. Less colour, more white.
Yeah, I've been working with César for 20 years. He's a good friend and really a brilliant, talented DOP. I mean, he's very experimental. He's always challenges me and it's really a great opportunity because he's such an artist. Mm-hmm. And you're right. I mean, the other films were quite experimental in the visual side and the way the film's cut. And this has a lot to do with César's work, not only mine. But I think in Blindness, we really went further because we had, in some way, we had to represent blindness, but with images. Mm-hmm. And so I think we came up with very good solutions. And some of the solutions, of course, or most of the solutions were César's ideas.
So, really?
We really work well together. I can't imagine shooting a film without him. You know?
Yeah, I mean, it would be, you know, I don't know who came up with the look. Is it something that you worked on together? You sort of say, yeah, I like that color there for the favelas, or I like this color for the Kenyan kind of desert, or?
No, we discussed a lot the concept and what the image needs to show or needs to hide. And he brings me, I mean, he keeps sending me photos, still photos of different propositions, and then we start watching all those images and references and start selecting things. And when we start the project, we don't know how the project will look like, you know, and then we start trying different things and different color corrections, and finally we find the film.
And do you do that on location? Do you start lighting it with different lights, or is it something you can do
after? No, before that, before we go to locations, César, he likes to take photos. He goes to the location by himself, alone, and he takes his photos, then he puts in his computer with Photoshop. He does color corrections, and he experiments till he gets interesting looks. And then we select together what we like, what we don't like. And with this reference, then that's how he plans how he's going to shoot the film.
The Brazilian magic of Fernando Morales there. And if you want to see the video version of this interview, go to guardian.co.uk/in-the-director's-chair. That's all I've got time for this week. A big thanks to all of my guests, to Fernando Moreiras, to Raymond DeFelita, and Zan Brooks, of course. Do pick up a copy of The Observer this Sunday to catch my Trailer Trash column, and why not join me on Facebook? It's Solomon's Film Weekly Cinephiles. That's the group. Gosh, we're so modern and young and hip and trendy. For now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer, Jason Phipps, till next week, goodbye.